Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 12, is brought to you by Wag and Third Love. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
If there is anything I've learned since diving into the world of wrongful convictions, and if there's anything that's been made painfully apparent thanks to current affairs swirling around the Russian ties to the U.S. presidency, it's this. The quality of an investigation is everything. The method of investigation, who's conducting it, and why they're conducting it has a direct impact on what the facts, and I say that in quotes, end up looking like, which doesn't always end up favoring the truth. Especially when an entity has to investigate itself, because while it has plenty of incentive to be very selective in how that investigation is conducted, and a lot of control in how the end results look. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. This is episode 12, Investigations. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and I'm here with my co-host, Justine Barron, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, and Amelia McDonald Perry.
My name is Amelia McDonald Perry, and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marcia Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
We have dedicated a number of resources from our force investigation team that are conducting investigations as we speak, and the investigation continues. I've been on the phone with the state's attorney's office, and we're going to work jointly on this investigation.
We have started a new task force. The task force to review this is part of our force investigation team. That investigates all force.
This investigation team is leading the way. We have homicide detectives assigned to it. We have district.
That we will impanel a blue ribbon committee to investigate this incident from the very beginning.
Over the course of the last 12 days, we have undertaken a massive investigation. We have ramped up a task force of more than 30 plus investigators from various disciplines in this agency. Dozens of interviews have been conducted, many more remain. A step-by-step, meticulous investigation is taking place.
Over the course of our independent investigation in the untimely death of Mr. Gray, my team worked around the clock, 12 and 14 hour days, to canvass and interview dozens of witnesses, view numerous hours of video footage, repeatedly reviewed and listened to hours of police videotaped statements, surveyed the route, reviewed voluminous medical records, and we leveraged the information made available to us by the police department, the community, and the family of Mr. Gray. The findings of our comprehensive...
In the weeks after Freddie Gray died, a wide range of investigations were promised to the public. Baltimore Police, or BPD, promised internal investigations that would be transparent, thorough, and hold officers accountable. Both the police and the state's attorney's office, or SAO, also promised various levels of independent investigations, civilian reviews, and a federal investigation. It's been more than 2 years since Freddie Gray's death, and many of these investigations have yet to be completed. Some of them may never have happened. There are also serious questions around whether the investigations that did take place were thorough and unbiased. The commissioner, mayor, and state's attorney all directed blame at police officers for their failure to follow policy, but their own investigations were not always by the book or as promised.
The investigation into Freddie Gray's injury kicked off when Brandon Ross, Freddie Gray's friend, called 911. That initiated what is known at BPD as a supervisor complaint.
Baltimore City 911, operator 132, what is the address of your emergency?
Yes, the 1700 block of Fulton is witness of assault, and I was wanting to file a complaint.
Okay, sir, can you please repeat that location?
1700 block of North Fulton.
And your phone number?
I would like to stay anonymous.
Okay, and can you give me a description of the person that was assaulted?
Yes, it was an incident for us with the officers involved, and actually I said witness the officers assault this guy, and I have it on camera, and I want to file a complaint. I'm all, you know, they told me I tried to go down to Western District, and no one came down to the door. I don't know why. It's a Sunday, so this is my next best step.
This was from Ross's second 911 call that morning, just before the ambulance arrived at the Western District Station. In court, he said again that he, quote, knocked repeatedly on the station door and nobody answered. The defense never challenged Ross's account about the door being locked. Why were the doors to the police station locked and for how long? Certainly, most of the sector patrol officers were occupied, but the Western employs other staff. Are we to believe that this was another quirk in the routine on April 12th and nothing to do with what was happening to Freddie Gray?
Let me tell you where the problem is going to come in, because you want to remain anonymous and you want to report.
Okay, okay. I don't mind remaining anonymous. I mean, I give my name when they get here.
Okay, well, I have to be able to let the officers know who you are. Does that make sense? Do they know who they're going to ask for?
Rodney 12.
Sergeant White followed up on Ross's 911 call later that morning by trying to contact, quote, Rodney Clark, the name he gave. She followed the steps in BPD policy K-15, use of force. She visited the scene, looked for witnesses, and submitted a report to her bosses who, presumably, passed it along to internal affairs. Ross was interviewed the next day by one of the investigators on the street. He described one of the officers putting a knee in Gray's back and tasing him, neither of which the officers said happened in their interviews. By the time Ross was interviewed, BPD had already mostly settled on a version of the story of what happened to Freddie Gray that didn't involve excessive force. Still, the investigation proceeded for a few weeks, and officers continued to be assigned to look for Rodney Clark, not putting together that they had already met him and discounted his version of events.
A few days before his retirement as Deputy Commissioner of Professional Standards and Accountability, on April 20th, Jerry Rodriguez was asked about how the investigation was proceeding. He answered that police hadn't interviewed any officers. He said, quote, "We cannot interview an officer administratively and compel them if an officer is the subject of the criminal investigation. Every person has the right against self-incrimination, so for us to compel an officer to provide a statement, that could potentially taint the criminal investigation." Well, he's right on principle, if not fact. By April 20th, six officers had given statements, waiving their rights. I guess Rodriguez didn't want to answer questions about what they said. Rodriguez's parting words do shed light on a major issue in how police investigate themselves. In Garrity versus New Jersey in 1967, the Supreme Court decided that police officers and other government employees cannot be compelled into testifying against themselves at the risk of losing their jobs or other serious employment penalty if the statement or any evidence derived from it is used against them in a criminal prosecution. So since the employer of government workers is the government itself, such interviews are basically statements given without Miranda rights or due process applied. Since then, statements given by government workers are given immunity from prosecution unless the workers waive their Miranda rights. As a result of Garrity, once police determine that an officer might be criminally liable, they are supposed to create a Chinese wall or a bifurcation between the criminal and administrative investigations. Internal Affairs handles administrative review or job performance. It can look at the entire criminal investigation, but the reverse isn't allowed. The criminal investigators can't use any statements given to Internal Affairs without the officers having waived their rights. Obviously, this is highly burdensome to smaller police departments, As a result, officers often aren't charged criminally. Rodriguez himself had been accused of a Garrity violation. In 2014, BPD Lieutenant Colonel Clifton McWhite was criminally charged with one count of theft for allegedly misrepresenting his educational background for a small pay raise. McWhite claimed that he believed that the diploma was from a legitimate online institution. He had a series of meetings with Rodriguez, during which he claimed Rodriguez promised to fix his problem if he came clean. Otherwise, he would face discipline. McWhite was 10 months shy of retirement, so, he claims, he was compelled into confessing to something he didn't think he did. Then, he was criminally charged for theft, based on his confession. The total he was accused of stealing? Only $1,700. The diploma cost as much, probably, if not more. McWhite's attorney, Ivan Bates, said that a police audit had turned up many other examples of cops submitting questionable diplomas, cops who didn't get criminally charged. So this case is not just a perfect example of Garrity, it also shows how retaliatory Batts' administration could be. The charges were dropped when McWhite resigned. It seems like they just wanted him out. We tend to think of accountability in policing as a positive thing, but it really depends on who's doing the accounting. Ivan Bates, by the way, represented Sergeant Alicia White in our case. And McWhite was one of Lieutenant Rice's supervisors when Rice had issues in Carroll County, so Baltimore is a really small town.
So, how do Garrity issues apply to the officers indicted in the death of Freddie Gray, the Baltimore Six? On April 12th, the day Gray was arrested, six officers came downtown to provide interviews to the Force Investigation Team, or FIT Squad, Lieutenant Rice, Sergeant White, and Officers Miller, Nero, Novak, and Goodson. So, all of the major players besides Porter. Novak and White were considered witnesses that first day. The rest were considered involved officers, and so had the right to not incriminate themselves. All of them waived their Miranda rights anyway, except Goodson. He refused to testify. And White, because she was considered a witness at first. There is a provision of Maryland's Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, or LIBOR Rights, that allows officers accused of misconduct 10 days before they have to answer any questions. But that is just in relation to their job status. That doesn't apply to a criminal investigation, during which they can, like civilians, choose to speak or remain silent. If they remain silent, then their bosses can compel their testimony within 10 days or risk being fired. That didn't happen to Goodson, but if it had, he might have had a good case that BPD failed to truly separate its administrative and criminal investigations. It's not clear that the Force Investigation Team knew which one it was running. Hey, it's Amelia. So 11 years ago this month, my dog Luca came into my life and we've been almost inseparable ever since. I say almost because as much as she enjoys coming with me to brunch and the beach and on weekend getaways, sometimes Luca's got to stay home. The confused and disappointed look on her face when I prepare to walk up the door never fails to tug at my heartstrings. Wait, you're leaving? Without me? But why? Her furrowed brow seems to be saying. It's emotionally manipulative, honestly, but her joy when I come home, even if I've been gone for only an hour, makes the guilt worth it. While I'm gone, however, I want to know she's being cared for by only the very best. After me, of course. That's when I use WAG. WAG is a private dog walking service that offers a range of booking options, from on-demand last-minute walks to pre-scheduled and recurring care for your pup. WAG automatically pairs you with the best walker nearest to you that fits your needs. So, the next time I'm at the beach with friends and don't want to rush home, I can arrange for a last-minute walk with WAG. I also go down to Baltimore quite a bit to do work for Undisclosed, and WAG gives me the peace of mind that there is always an animal lover nearby who can check in on my girl. But my favorite thing about WAG is their app, which tracks every stage of your dog's walk so you can see where they're going and what they're doing in real time. The pee and poop icons take the experience to the next level. There's something very reassuring about knowing my dog is doing her business as usual, even when I'm not home. All walkers are thoroughly vetted and tested on dog handling experience and professionalism, so I know Luca is in good hands. WAG is a must-have for every dog owner, and if you sign up today, you'll get your first walk for free. No promo code needed. WAG will make your life a little easier, and your dog will be happier from the extra care. Isn't that right, Luca? So again, download WAG on iTunes or Google Play and automatically get your first dog walk for free at sign up.
The force investigation team will look into major uses of force, like when a gun is fired or a head is hit.
Is this police officers investigating police officers?
This is the elected executive members of this agency working together with the state's attorney's office, reviewing the facts and coming to a very educated opinion.
That's a brotherhood. They're gonna take care of each other. So I think it needs to be an outside entity that's looking into the complaints.
There are 15 incidents listed this year involving guns, tasers, vehicles, and a head injury. A civilian review board will see the complaint before any changes are handed down.
And I think this organization needs to be applauded for taking these steps today. I don't see any agencies in the state of Maryland doing this.
Commissioner Batts will get a complete report in 72 hours. Then recommendations will be made that the department calls different and innovative.
And it is the police department that will decide which cases get reported at all. If you want to check out the map with more details, we have a link in the story.
In June 2014, WMAR Baltimore reported on Batts's new model for investigating force, a team that would initially oversee the Freddie Gray investigation. In the old system, uses of force under policy K-15 would be investigated by the first line rank supervisor and then passed up the chain of command. Homicide would investigate in-custody death, or what is called categorical use of force, meaning major injuries. If the state's attorney decided not to prosecute, then the investigation would shift into an internal affairs investigation. Otherwise, the administrative investigation would wait until the criminal investigation was done. Batts brought in a new model, the Force Investigation Team, from a Department of Justice-funded program in Las Vegas, which he called his Bible. Actually, Las Vegas's Fit Squad didn't work out, and it was shut down after 2 years, and then reintroduced, and it still faces a lot of criticism. But theoretically, it's a best practice model. Specialized force investigation squads have become a major trend in policing. When Fit was advertised to the public, BPD promised to post use of force incidents online. The next year, the Baltimore Sun and City Paper exposed how few of the investigations had been posted. Investigations were also supposed to be reviewed by a community board. That wasn't happening. On first review of the investigation into Freddie Gray's death, we noticed a lot of basic problems with the Fit Squad's work. Many of the cops at the scene were not interviewed. The van was not put into evidence, so no DNA or fingerprints were collected. The accident team wasn't called in, which should have happened for even a minor accident. Footage from security cameras was never collected. The interviews that we read or heard, such as Dante Allen's, they weren't probing, to say the least. And Officer Novak, a witness, was given a huge amount of power. Also, Detectives Michael Boyd and Sarita Teal, who led the interviews, had relationships with the officers. They had worked with them at the Western District just before their placement on the Fit Squad. Teal describes giving Novak a hug when she sees him on the 12th, and again giving Porter a hug right before she interrogates him. Seth Stoughton, former police officer turned criminal justice professor, describes the issue here.
I imagine this is a big issue with police investigating themselves, right? You're dealing with friends.
Sure, friends and coworkers. At a very large agency, New York, Chicago, even Baltimore, I would say generally, it's not as much of an issue because most of the time there are so many officers that the investigators are not personally or closely acquainted with the officers. But at mid-sized police agencies and smaller agencies, yes, it's a huge issue.
If you have a department the size of Baltimore, I mean, do you think they should try to avoid that? Is it something to be avoided?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It can't help but color the investigation in some way. Officers, like many of us, believe that we can put all that to the side and be objective. they're wrong. That's not possible. There is ample psychological evidence that tells us that our biases, like observer expectancy bias and confirmation bias, cannot be resolved through a matter of will or desire. They affect the way that we think without us even being aware of it. So yes, that is something to be avoided.
Sarita Teal was named the lead investigator of the case and stayed in that role for most of April. She had never overseen a homicide case before. She had only been on the squad for about 2 months. But maybe what is most concerning about the FIT investigation is that it's not clear if it was doing a criminal or an administrative investigation into Freddie Gray's injuries. This should not be a hard question to answer, and it matters.
If I'm doing a potential homicide investigation, or if I'm running an investigation like a homicide investigator, I am going to send out a canvassing team. I and other officers are going to go knock on a whole bunch of doors and ask people what they heard and where they were when the incident occurred. And I want as many pieces of evidence as possible. Now, there are going to be complete inconsistencies, right? Some people are going to just get it wrong. Some people are going to misremember. Some people aren't going to have any information. But I do that because I want the most possible information. If I'm just investigating whether there was a violation of policy, those witnesses are not particularly relevant. Maybe you would ask them, were you out here and did you see the interaction? And if the answer is no, you go, okay, well, then I don't really need to ask anything else. But in a homicide investigation, it's, were you out there and did you see the interaction? Okay, you weren't out there. Did you hear any part of the interaction? Okay, in the 15 minutes following the interaction, what did you see? Who did you speak to? What did you hear? And that's just the very, very tip of the iceberg.
So if the officers investigating what happened to Freddie Gray were doing a criminal investigation, they would ask, how did Gray die? If they were doing an administrative investigation, they would ask, did police follow the policies? Batts housed the new FIT department within Internal Affairs under the leadership of Garnell Green. When FIT Detective Michael Boyd took the stand, Prosecutor Janice Bledsoe asked, quote, can you just generally describe what the duties of the FIT team would be? He answered, quote, we would conduct an investigation of the facts, see where they fell as far as training and policy was concerned. We then present our findings to a board, which consisted of a few of the commanders, deputy commissioners, and they would determine if the officer was acting in policy or out of policy, and if any training needed to be addressed. That is a clear-cut description of an administrative investigation. That is all about policy. It's not about crime. Batts outlined his vision for FIT in Policy 710, Categorical Use of Force and In-Custody Death Response. The policy is way confusing. It's not clear what type of investigation is being completed. It goes back and forth. After Batts was fired, the new commissioner, Kevin Davis, got rid of the FIT team. He created a similar unit called Special Investigation Response Team, moved the department back inside of Homicide, and staffed it with trained investigators. Davis updated Policy 710. It now begins with an insistence upon separate but concurrent criminal and administrative investigations, and it cites Garrity. I reached out to BPD. I requested training and policy documents for the FIT squad from 2014 to 2015. They couldn't provide any. They could only provide documents related to their news squad. I have a feeling that the FIT squad may not have had any training. It seems like Batts, a police commissioner that worked in three large cities, did not understand Garrity. He and his deputies constantly referred to turning over the investigation results to the state's attorney. You don't bother with the state's attorney unless there might be charges. And here he is, in a press conference in 2014, describing how he thinks the system works in Baltimore.
In my previous jobs, when I had an incident that were egregious to this nature, to this line, I took all my internal affairs people and we did an investigation immediately. If it came back through that investigation, we put all our resources on that event. So we would go out, look at the cameras, interview everyone in a short amount of time. where I, in the past, I sit down with the employee, we'd interview the employee, get all the information. It was found that that case, we would put it in the forefront, and I have fired people within 15 to 30 days if they were found guilty with egregious acts along those lines.
But you can't do that here, am I correct?
The law does not allow. The system that I was talking about is a bifurcated system where you have a legal arm and you have an administrative arm. And those systems, they run away from each other. They run separate from each other. And this one is monolithic. You have to do the criminal first, and after the criminal is finished, then you take the administrative.
Bats like to complain about things that got in his way, but he's actually wrong here. Garrity is a federal law. Maryland's LIBOR rules state this about internal affairs investigations against police. Quote, related criminal investigation, administrative investigations may be conducted simultaneously. It appears that Bats hobbled together the Fit Squad quickly, filled it with underexperienced investigators, and left it to internal affairs to train and manage it, neglecting the department's obligation to conduct a criminal investigation. Our concerns about the FIT investigation were validated when we received two big binders of material through a Public Information Act request with the state's attorney's office. These were the binders that BPD turned over when it concluded the first phase of its investigation, although they've been redacted here and there. The binders include hundreds of pages of documents and notes that fill in some of our knowledge gaps and also reaffirm a lot of our theories. They arrived just 2 weeks ago. Better late than never. The binders reflect a FIT investigation that definitely kept busy, canvassing neighborhoods, writing reports, but was not trying too hard to get to the bottom of what happened, and that worse, allowed the suspects themselves to shape the story. And so much of what went wrong happened on day one. Here's FIT Detective Michael Boyd talking about his job. Okay, that's impossible to hear. Sorry. It's Boyd having a chat with Sergeant Alicia White before he interviewed her on the day of Freddie Gray's arrest. I used some technical hocus-pocus to pull up his voice, but I could clearly make this out. Boyd told White that he sits there and does nothing, basically. He said that the team was called in that Sunday to complete the 24-hour report. Then he lists the four-person squad that day and he says, "We don't do much work now." Then Boyd and White entered the interview room, and Boyd proceeded to administer a softball interview to White, as he gave the same day to Dante Allen and the other officers. White's was one of the last interviews of the day. By then, Rice, Miller, Nero, and Dante Allen had put together a story suggesting that Freddie Gray injured himself after stop five by being combative and banging himself against the van. Only White seemed to suggest that there might have been more to the story.
But at that point, there was no, it wasn't no red flags were coming up. Nothing was giving you cause to say, let's get a medic for him now?
No.
Okay. And that's the only contact you had with him?
Correct. The only thing that they kept saying, and I'm the type, like, I mean, they always like, well, he just has jail-itis. You know, that was kind of the words that they used. Like, he just has jail-itis. He doesn't want to go to jail. And I'm like, you know, you don't know that, but, you know, once we got to the district and I seen how he was.
It sounds like White heard the other cops saying that Gray had jailitis, but she was skeptical. Then she saw what happened to him at the district and realized that they might have been wrong. Boyd and his interview partner, Peremski, steamroll right over this with the next question.
The district and I seen how he was. So
when you get to the district, they had already had him out of the wagon.
No,
he was still in the wagon. So when you get there, who was all there?
White was reinterviewed on the 17th by Detectives Teal and Charles Anderson. Her story has shifted by then, subtly.
Did you have a conversation with Porter on the scene about Mr. Gray? Officer Porter?
It was kind of like, it was like LT there, it was Nero there. So it was kind of like all these officers standing there, and I believe Officer Porter had said he knew who Freddie was. And that they kind of use the terminology like, oh, he just has jailitis. You know, and that's all they basically, you know, said. That, you know, I guess kind of like he didn't really want to go to jail or whatever. That's why he probably was acting out the way that he was acting out.
interview notes in the binders confirm that the FIT investigation under Detective Teal wasn't looking hard at discrepancies. They made notes and put stars next to a few things they wanted to sort out, like taser usage. They sought easy answers, and they defaulted towards believing the cops. Teal's interview notes, as well as other documents in the binders, support many of our suspicions about the official timeline of the arrest. If you recall, at trial, all of the officers claimed that the van stopped at Mountain Baker, or stop 2, because the bike officers decided to stay out and send Gray to central booking. But on April 12th, the cops weren't saying that. They said they moved the van from stop 1 to stop 2 because Freddie was acting combative and crowds were forming. By the trials, they didn't want to suggest that they used stop 2 to deal with Gray. The investigative binders also support the theory that stop 4 didn't happen as described in court, that maybe Porter didn't meet Goodson at Druid Hill and Dolphin to check on Freddie Gray. There was no CCTV video provided to support the stop, despite the numerous cameras in the area, and Porter's story about it changed a lot. In fact, according to Detective Teal's notes, Porter said that stop 4 took place at Druid Hill and Baker, not Dolphin. Stop 4 is missing from almost all of the interviews and from Goodson's run sheets. Run sheets are where cops write down all the stops they made and what happened at them. On Goodson's run sheet, he writes that he was at 1700 Presbury, the scene of the arrest, from 8:35 until, well, he crosses out the end time. Then he says he was at 1600 West North, or stop 5, at 9:25, which leaves a big gap in time. Rice and Nero word their run sheets exactly the same way. 1700 Presbury and 1600 West North Avenue. They aren't even precise addresses for where they were located and not how the other cops describe those locations. It seems like the run sheets might have been a collaborative process. It's natural to assume that the officers and even investigators were collaborating on the story. After Freddie Gray was taken to the hospital, all of the officers hung around the Western District for a couple hours, besides Porter, who performed hospital duty. They can be seen talking to each other and other officers in crime scene photographs. In court, Teal described seeing them communicating with each other, the investigators, and Dante Allen, freely. Then, the officers arrived downtown around 12:30 p.m., according to a log that was used to document everyone's arrival. Over the next 4 hours, their tasers were inspected and they were interviewed. It does not seem like they were kept in separate rooms. Teal described seeing cops arriving and talking, Miller bringing over evidence, Novak filling out a report. Most of them remained downtown for a while. That night, Novak dropped off the knife at evidence control, and then he and Miller went to the court commissioners to fill out the charging documents after 11 p.m. That's a lot of time during which the main officers were able to freely communicate about what happened, including with the investigators, their buddies.
Totally true story. I had a friend visiting me the other week, and I had a bunch of boxes by the front door, packages that had arrived but I hadn't opened yet, and she saw the one on top and got really excited because it was from Third Love. She's a huge fan of their products, and it wasn't until I tried on the bra that I got from Third Love that I understood why she was so excited. And let me tell you why you should be too, because ladies, you can stop tugging at your bra straps and second guessing your size. It is time to put fit first with Third Love. Third Love uses women's real measurements and super smoothing memory foam to create bras that fit better and are more comfortable, and I promise you, they're going to be one of the most comfortable bras you've ever worn. Gorgeous material. They offer sizes from AA to G, as well as their exclusive half cup sizes. You just have to answer a few simple questions online, and Third Love will recommend a bra in the right size and style for you. And right now, Third Love is offering you a chance to try one of their perfect 24/7 bras free for just 30 days. All you do is pay $2.99 for shipping, and you are on your way to a perfect fit. You'll get to really live in this bra. Feel free to wash it, wear it all day. You might even forget that you're wearing it. If Third Love isn't your favorite new bra, you can just return it or exchange it for free. Go to thirdlove.com/undisclosed now to get your perfect Third Love bra and try it for 30 days. That's thirdlove.com/undisclosed to try your new favorite bra for free. thirdlove.com/undisclosed.
We've talked a lot about Officer Novak in this podcast, the one who got away. Well, he got immunity from prosecution. We've described him lurking around many parts of the case. We've talked about him submitting the knife into evidence and, oddly, appearing on the knife chain of custody report later, when he was supposed to be on leave and not a part of the investigation. We've talked about Novak having an informal interview with Dante Allen, during which he gave him his phone number and a fake name. This interview, which took place just after Novak told the paramedic that he thought maybe Gray had banged his head, and just before Dante Allen told Boyd and Paremski the same thing. So, Novak. Well, it turns out that Novak was named primary officer that first day by Sergeant Gaines, who ran the force investigation team. Primary officer is a very specific short-term designation. It usually goes to the first officer on the scene of an incident. The main job of the primary officer is to write an initial offense report and, according to policy 0207, quote, make critical observations of the crime. The primary officer is not supposed to be one of the witnesses, and Novak was identified as a witness early on. So here's what Seth Stoughton had to say about this discovery when I told him that Novak was named primary.
That is batshit crazy. You don't have an officer who is involved in the officer-involved homicide as the primary or play any sort of investigative role into that officer-involved homicide. That's, you know, that's kind of like asking an officer who was involved in a potential policy violation to be part of the investigative team that looks into the policy violation. That's insane. That's I can't even think of a good description.
I like that shit crazy, and I'm gonna use that.
Yeah, I'm still stumbling over this. So at this point, you have a death investigation, or you actually, I guess he wasn't dead at that point yet, but you have a serious bodily injury investigation.
Same category, yeah. They would use they call that on the same level, yeah.
Okay, anyone who is involved in the underlying incident is a witness who needs to have their information taken by an investigator. They are not an investigator who should be doing anything investigative.
Not surprisingly, Novak's incident report is filled with mentions of Freddie being combative and making loud banging noises, even at stop 5 when everyone else describes Freddie as immobile. Not everyone was on board with Gaines' decision to make Novak the primary. In court, Teal said that Detective Anderson, her partner, called Sergeant Gaines to express his concerns. He had been out canvassing with Novak and Teal. Gaines wasn't concerned. Neither was Teal. Novak comes off in his reports and his court appearances as sort of the Eddie Haskell of the investigation. A do-gooder that is probably up to no good. Novak received use and derivative use immunity from prosecution in exchange for his grand jury testimony. This means that he could still be prosecuted if the cops had other evidence besides his testimony. He did turn over his personal cell phone to the state's attorney's office in exchange for that immunity. The phone showed only one text with Lieutenant Rice. The cell phone toll records, however, showed one other text with Rice, 4 messages from Dante Allen throughout April, and several contacts with Miller and Nero on the 12th, all of which were erased. Novak was on leave briefly and then went back to working patrol in the Western District. He recently got a big raise. Towards the end of the first day of the investigation, Detective Teal wrote up a 24-hour report, which was sent up the chain of command. It listed the involved officers and witnesses and included a few paragraphs about what happened. It starts like this, quote, on Sunday, April 12, 2015, at approximately 09:11 hours, Lieutenant Brian Rice, Officer Garrett Miller, and Officer Edward Nero were on bike patrol in the area of the 1600 block of North Avenue. Hold up. 9:11 a.m.? That's almost a half hour after the chase actually started. Novak's own police report starts the same way. The chase starts at 9:11. He should have known better. He was around. It turns out that 9/11 came from a dispatch report. That's when the incident was first logged. But starting the chase at 9/11 might have benefited the officers. They had to account for less time spent driving around a young man who ended up in critical condition. This 24-hour report, after the chase, left out the names of all of the officers besides Goodson, the wagon driver. It makes it seem like Goodson, alone, decided to move the wagon to stop too, shackle Gray's legs, and pick up Dante Allen. Nobody was described as arresting Gray. Maybe it's a coincidence, but Miller and Nero also strategically avoided mentioning that Miller arrested Gray. Then, on a witness summons form, Miller signed his name and checked a box underneath his name for arresting officer, only he crossed out the word arresting. There's no way to mistake the intention behind that choice. He wanted to avoid blame.
The story told in the 24-hour report jumped from stop 2 to stop 5 and then dedicated a full paragraph to Dante Allen. It says, quote, "According to Dante Allen, during the transport from North and Mount, he could hear Mr. Gray banging against the walls of the wagon compartment. Dante Allen went on to say that it is his belief Mr. Gray was intentionally trying to hurt himself. Mr. Allen advised while they were being transported, the ride was not bumpy, nor was the wagon being driven erratically or making abrupt stops and starts." And so on. Then it ends with the prisoner being found unconscious. Maybe not purposefully, Teal arrived at a conclusion in this report, and with only a handful of interviews conducted and no access yet to CCTV or audio dispatch. The report focuses on Dante Allen's perception of Gray's injury and leaves off, for instance, Brandon Ross's 911 call and Kevin Moore's interview. This report would continue to be used as a boilerplate for warrant applications and press conferences. For the rest of the investigation, we will continue to see the dual stories that take shape in this report, one in which Freddie injured himself by being that combative, and the other in which Goodson is the culpable officer, as Gray's custodian. Indeed, the investigative binders contain two receipts for casebooks delivered by BPD to the state's attorney's office. One is for Freddie Gray, the other is for Officer Goodson. Teal went on some kind of medical leave soon after the charges were filed, which was credited to emotional stress. She eventually landed back in internal affairs. Boyd was soon transferred back to the Western District Detective Unit. Sergeant Gaines left shortly after Freddie Gray's death to pursue a career in broadcasting. Rodriguez, as you know, retired. And Garnell Green, who oversaw FIT, retired just after Batts was fired, although some say that Davis forced him out. This squad existed for less than a year, and its insufficient leadership and staffing seems to have played some role in failures of the case against the officers involved in Freddie Gray's death.
The day after Freddie Gray died, Batts and the mayor held a big, long press conference, laying out the timeline of the arrest and promising accountability. Batts introduced the task force, the 30-plus member team that would now investigate what happened to Freddie Gray. He said this as if there had been no investigation thus far.
The task force to review this is part of our force investigation team that investigates all force. Our crime lab will be part of this task force. Our homicide investigators will be a part of this task force. Our training academy will also be a part of the task force that will bring to the state's attorney's office in the week after next, the conclusion of all these revelations.
Batts liked task forces, from what I've heard. He liked the performance of it. He had commissioned several before, including one to deal with the Joe Crystal case. If you remember, Joe Crystal was that whistleblower that Batts pushed out of BPD. There is a list of over 30 people comprising the task force in one of the investigative binders, but the major players, according to Boyd in court, were homicide detectives, with Teal still nominally in charge. They all reported to homicide major Stanley Branford. Those are the names we see mostly in the binders. Our concerns about the FIT investigation were validated by what happened when Homicide took over. They ordered the van brought back out of service and tested for DNA. They called in the accident team, looked for security footage. They tried to figure out the route. They interviewed the rest of the cops and the civilians that were on the scene at the various stops. One of the Homicide detectives even rewatched all of the interviews and took fresh notes. The task force gave the impression of a lot of work getting done, and competently. When Detective Danielle Taylor interviewed Officer Gladhill on April 26th, she sounded like she meant business. She asked him to be more forthcoming with information so that she didn't have to pull it all out of him. She pointed out how nervous he was. She sounded more like a real investigator than TLM Boyd. But timing with investigations matters. By the time Homicide took over, DNA was already potentially compromised. Much of the available security footage had been erased. The remaining officers had had the time to get their stories together, and the other officers did not have to consent to another interview. Even the best trained investigators, however, operating right on time, might not deliver a good case if they don't have sincere motivations. If you look below the surface activity, the task force seems to have been driven by an agenda, namely to limit the officer's appearance of guilt. On May 2nd, the day after Mosby announced charges against the officers, the Baltimore Sun published an article called "Exclusive Look Inside the Freddie Gray Investigation," written by Justin George. George was given access to the investigation as it proceeded, he said, and the chance to write about it in a series of articles, including this article and a four-part series later that year. If you've been listening to the podcast so far, it probably won't surprise you to hear that these articles offer a glowing portrait of BPD at work. The police investigators are described as sincere, hardworking, well-intentioned, and put upon. They were, quote, "working for 2 weeks to complete an investigation that otherwise might have taken months," George wrote, and the work, quote, "took a personal toll." They were trying to resolve 145 separate tasks. They, quote, "met two, sometimes three times a day." No, not three. George describes the investigators hard at work, rolling a $250,000 laser imaging device down the street to capture the van's route, while having to disguise their identity after the riots. They pass angry residents and a "fuck the police" sign. But still, George wrote, quote, "they all realized the importance of their investigation and that they were part of a pivotal moment in Baltimore history. Amid the allegations of brutality, they wanted to show that they would leave no stone unturned." Oy, if this is sounding to you like carefully crafted police PR, then, well, here's more. Justin George's first article on May 2nd opens with this scene. The task force is observing a doctor and two training officers demonstrating how the leg hold used by Officer Miller could not have caused Gray's fatal injury. Then, Major Stanley Branford is described as checking off another one of his tasks. Problem solved. Miller didn't kill Gray. And hey, the Baltimore Sun just happened to capture this moment as it occurred. Branford is the hero protagonist of these stories. He is described as having, quote, "a calm demeanor, quick wit, and an uncanny ability to memorize facts without taking notes." Justin George leaves off the sexual harassment complaints against him. I guess they weren't as relevant as his wit. In the May 2nd article, Justin George acknowledges that he agreed to not publish until the state's attorney had decided whether or not to press charges. Why? Why would a major newspaper let the police department decide when it can publish what it's learned? It's not like there were lives at stake. Then, George didn't publish the longer four-part series on the investigation until October, 5 months later. No, I don't think it took him 5 months to write this magnum opus. It's clear enough that he was waiting again for another okay from BPD. By October, the pretrial hearings were ramping up. Porter's trial was happening soon. So, recap. first article was published one day after the charges. That is, one day after Mosby announced that her office did their own independent investigation and that the BPD investigation was insufficient. And the second set of articles was published just before the trials. Got it. Justin George did a Q&A with readers and admitted that he wasn't actually embedded in the investigation. The state's attorney refused to allow it. Instead, he got different opportunities to visit. Yeah. What troubles me the most about George's articles is they lack some basic investigative reporting standards. They don't offer alternate point of views. They sometimes don't provide dates or names. At one point, George writes, quote, "The task force members continued to investigate all the possibilities, even though they felt confident that Gray had suffered a catastrophic injury." Who felt confident? All of them? When? Before or after meeting Dr. Carol Allen? Because that makes a big difference. Then George writes, quote, "They discovered that the van's video camera was broken and that one of the officers during the transport said Gray had jailitis, a faked illness, when he complained about his condition." No, that camera was never broken. It wasn't the type to record, which the investigators knew. And by talking about the catastrophic injury and jailitis in the same breath, George basically endorses the theory that Gray wasn't actually hurt in any way before what happened in the van. At the least, he makes it seem like the investigators all shared this view. "Whatever happened," he quotes one detective as saying, "happened in the van." That again. Why do these people even bother investigating? Two of the four articles in the longer series are accompanied by these highly produced videos showing the investigators at work with this stirring music played in the background. The first video is dated April 27th. It shows two detectives canvassing the neighborhoods.
We're doing a follow-up investigation of what happened to Mr. Perry Gray. So any information, if you know anything about the incident, if you talk to anyone, or if you heard anything, you know, we'd be glad to take that information so we can make sure.
We've constructed an incredibly detailed timeline of the investigation, down to each hour. While the task force did re-canvass the neighborhood when they took over, it seems like that effort was completed by the 22nd. By April 27th, when this video was shot, the investigation was no longer seeking civilian witnesses. Then this video shows the same very charismatic detective showing up at the Head Start building and inquiring about their footage. According to the Baltimore Sun, police had already requested Head Start footage on April 20th, a week earlier, and found nothing relevant, though they only looked at 5 minutes of tape. Maybe this second visit was about getting the video ripped or something, I don't know. Maybe I'm suggesting that this video is staged for the Sun. Okay, I'm suggesting it. The second video in the task force articles is more troublesome, although it has the same fun music. It takes place on the next day, April 28th, showing the same officers breaking into Officer Goodson's locker and removing his clothes, papers, and gear. This video has no dialogue, just that snazzy music and some artful stills and jump cuts. Like it shows big bolt cutters forcing open the lock, and then it cuts dramatically to a close-up of a half-broken lock on the ground. What's troublesome about this video is that it's clearly implicating Goodson as a person of fault. At one point, one of the officers even looks at the stuff from the locker and then turns towards the camera, dramatically shaking his head. It's as if he's seen a bloody knife. It's just clothes and paper. In fact, there is a mound of evidence in these articles, in the investigative files, and elsewhere to suggest that the task force was looking at if and how to make sure that Goodson was the only officer blamed for Gray's death. This goes back to day one. Goodson is the only officer named in the 24-hour report after the chase. And it extends to the release of the video for Stop 3, which allegedly shows Goodson checking in the back on Gray, but which has no time or date and does not clearly identify Goodson. The accompanying article to this second video does say that the decision to search Goodson's locker was controversial within the department. Batts and the commanders wanted to test for blood, but there was hesitation among the detectives. They were aware that Goodson was possibly going to be charged with manslaughter. Batts also wanted to compel Goodson to testify. The rest of the task force resisted. Even Davis, who says, quote, "If the state's attorney finds out that we've learned something administratively that they can't use criminally, they would have a problem with that," Davis said. That's a Garrity issue. That's all that legal stuff that wasn't in Batts' wheelhouse. He didn't seem to care. He wanted what he called in the article the, quote, "truth." Or maybe he wanted a scapegoat to satisfy the public. The Baltimore Sun wasn't the only media outlet suggesting that the investigation was focused on Goodson. WBAL's Jane Miller had sources telling her as much.
This investigation that is now in the hands of the city state's attorney's office really focuses on a couple of very key questions. One, is there something that the driver of the police wagon did to cause Freddie Gray to slide into the back of the van, to somehow injure his head with such force that it snapped his neck and caused that severe spinal cord injury?
And Miller also reported that both Rice and Goodson had troubled backstories.
According to sources, Lieutenant Brian Rice, the shift commander of the officers who chased and arrested Freddie Gray, had been previously suspended from regular duty several times. All were related to off-duty domestic allegations. None resulted in convictions. And the wagon driver, Caesar Goodson, we've learned, is currently awaiting internal disciplinary proceedings for allowing a prisoner to escape from a hospital. Goodson is a key figure in the Gray investigation because as the wagon driver, he has primary responsibility for Gray's safety during transport.
Someone must have leaked this information about Goodson's employment issues to Miller. Not necessarily her now wife, Janice Bledsoe, the lead prosecutor. What's interesting about it is that it tries to find some equivalent between Lieutenant Rice's history of ritual harassment of his ex-girlfriend and bothering his local police departments and suspensions of duty with Goodson unable to hold on to a prisoner who escaped while at the hospital. If anything, Goodson's story indicates that he's willing to take prisoners to the hospital. Justin George's articles describe the task force officers surprised by the revelation of the charges on May 1st. George describes how, on Wednesday night, Batts asked Branford to wrap up the investigation and submit it to the state's attorney the next morning. So he stayed up late on his birthday and copied files until 3:30 in the morning. George describes Branford's delivery of this binder as if he's writing a children's book about a girl and her dollhouse. Quote, "Branford didn't finish copying the files until 3:30 a.m. He took the case file home, told his wife what he was about to do, and snapped some photos of the file as a keepsake. The next morning, Branford placed the thick file in a blue tote bag and returned to police headquarters. It was less than a half-mile walk, but he felt the weight of history in his hands. He waited for walk signs before he crossed streets, fearful a car might hit him, scattering hundreds of important documents over the street," he later said, recalling that morning's events. And then all of that emotion and connection was destroyed in an instant when bad guy prosecutor Michael Schatzow responded to his delivery dismissively, saying, "Materials, huh? Wow, are these articles biased?" Anyway, it's likely that Batts and maybe even Branford knew about the charges coming down on Friday. Batts moved his own press conference announcing the investigation's conclusions from Friday to Thursday out of what he called a barely believable urgency. In fact, a major protest was scheduled that Saturday, hosted by activist Malik Shabazz. By Marilyn Mosby issuing charges that Friday, it helped turn what could have been another scene of violence, at least as BPD feared it would happen, to a positive celebration. Batts moving his own press conference a day up gave room for Mosby's announcement.
If you watch a lot of television or movie crime dramas, you are probably familiar with the classic stock character of the internal affairs officer, the pesky police investigator who tries to sniff out corruption Or you may have noticed references to BIA, the bureau that represents all that is wrong with policing. On screen, internal affairs officers are so disconnected from the life of real cops, and they can imperil the work of good cops or cops who go a little rogue, or they have to constantly watch their backs. Internal affairs divisions on television and movies are where the rats live, and when they or others expose the misdeeds of police officers, there is always hell to pay. Strangely, this characterization of the hostility toward internal affairs is not as fantastical or fictional as you would think, and the origin story of internal affairs is as Hollywood as it gets. The impetus for the first Internal Affairs Bureau was a red-hot police scandal in 1940s Los Angeles. In 1948, an LA Vice Squad officer was having an affair with Brenda Allen, a local madam, whose business was protected by members of the LAPD. When an officer killed a would-be robber at Allen's house, the relationship between the madam and the police department was exposed. After a wiretap, a trial, and with the mayor's office clamoring to get the stories out of the papers, a new chief of police, William A. Wharton, was appointed to lead reform. One of Wharton's first moves was the creation of an Internal Affairs Bureau. As part of Wharton's reorganization plan for an extremely concerning LAPD, his Bureau of Internal Affairs was tasked with dealing with, quote, complaints against officers and department employees. Internal Affairs had the authority to investigate officers and to order trials and mandate punishments, which could include transfers or disciplinary actions. Wharton only served LAPD for 14 months and mentored his Director of Internal Affairs, William H. Parker, to take over as chief upon his departure. Parker went on to serve as chief of police between 1950 and 1966, some of LAPD's most turbulent years. And like police chiefs across the country, he never perfected the system that Wharton started, the one in which the police are tasked with policing themselves. Baltimore Police Department's internal affairs has its own share of drama, which a larger public has been exposed to due to the Department of Justice's 2016 report on the problems of the Baltimore Police Department. The Department of Justice report on BPD characterizes internal affairs as ineffective and indifferent to civilian complaints and discouraging of officers to do the right thing. The report also mentions that in September of 2014, a man complained that a Central District police officer stopped and subjected him to a partial strip search multiple times over several days. When the man complained to Internal Affairs and offered the officer's name to the Internal Affairs investigator, despite evidence to corroborate the officer did stop the man those days, the complaint was deemed, quote, not sustained, and the investigation was abandoned. The DOJ determined that unlawful strip searches were a frequent complaint brought to Internal Affairs, yet was rarely pursued. An analysis of the Internal Affairs database by the DOJ found that there had been more than 60 complaints about strip searches over a six-year period, but the complaints only yielded one sustained investigation, meaning an investigation that was not immediately dismissed or reclassified as a lesser problem to circumvent action. After analyzing statistics from the BPD's Internal Affairs database, investigators also found only 5 complaints total between the years of 2010 and 2016 classified as an incident involving a racial slur or other racial bias. This did not square away with what many have reported about the BPD, and the Department of Justice concluded that the, quote, absence of such records stems from at least 2 procedural deficiencies. The first was that BPD had created what they described as significant obstacles to filing complaints. And they also found that when Baltimore residents were able to file complaints of racism, BPD repeatedly found ways to, quote, mask their racial elements. The DOJ concluded that, as a result, BPD does not investigate the frequent allegations of race-related misconduct made against its officers and has no mechanism to track such allegations to correct discriminatory policing where it occurs. In more serious situations, like excessive use of force, the DOJ reported a common practice of bypassing the chain of command for internal investigations. In excessive use of force cases, supervisors are required to file an internal claim with Internal Affairs, but these types of complaints were described by the DOJ as exceedingly rare. In the 5-year review period, the DOJ only found 10 reports. In an interview by one sergeant, by DOJ investigators, the sergeant admitted that he would not feel comfortable filing a complaint with Internal Affairs if he suspected an officer under his supervision had used unnecessary or unreasonable force. Instead, he would call his chain of command and inform them of the situation, leaving it to them to make the decision of whether to file a complaint against the officer for Internal Affairs to investigate. The DOJ has collected multiple instances of retaliation in the report, including Joe Crystal's claim that he was harassed for turning in an officer for planting drugs on a suspect. The retaliation comes after officers revealed the use of excessive force, racial slurs, and other clear violations of policy and protocol. A patrol officer was denied 30 days of overtime after she questioned her sergeant's direction that she clear corners. The patrol officer believed that the clearing techniques were in fact unconstitutional because she was asked to stop and question people with no probable cause. She raised the issue with her district major, and he agreed that she should be denied the overtime because she failed to make stats, meaning she didn't meet a minimum standard of stops. A sergeant in a separate incident claimed she was retaliated against because she raised concerns about her lieutenant telling officers to focus on, quote, black hoodies while on patrol. In Baltimore, if a person has a complaint about a police officer, there is another mechanism to file a grievance besides Internal Affairs. This brings us to a movement that has also tried to realize police reform from the outside with mixed results. Recognizing that Internal Affairs was and still is an ineffective way for communities to address police misconduct, the Civilian Review Board system has been introduced in some cities to respond to cases of abuse, brutality, racial discrimination, and other violations of the public trust. Los Angeles is also important to the history of civilian review. In 1928, the Los Angeles Bar Association formed the Committee on Constitutional Rights to track complaints against the police, but their role was to simply collect information. They couldn't enforce anything. Attempts at civilian review were initiated and failed across the country, and finally the idea stuck in the nation's capital. In 1948, the District of Columbia established the Complaint Review Board, and over the course of roughly 20 years, the board only reviewed about 50 or so cases. The Police Advisory Board in Philadelphia followed in the 1950s. Then the Civil Rights Movement changed everything, and calls for greater community control of neighborhood schools, business ownership, and police oversight turned the once far-left idea into a viable policy plan. In 1966, New York allowed four members of the public to join their local civilian review board. This and other victories were short-lived, with police unions using ballot initiatives to abolish or severely restrict these boards. Berkeley, California would eventually agree on a model that allowed for a truly independent civilian review system that could allow for investigations and more community action. Since 1999, Baltimore's Civilian Review Board, which sits in the Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement, reviews complaints about BPD, as well as Baltimore City School Police, Baltimore City Sheriff's Office, Baltimore Watershed Police, Environmental Police, Baltimore City Community College Police, and Morgan State University's Police Force. In February of 2015, then-Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake appointed Keisha Brown as the director of the office, and Brown has taken it upon herself to notify the public of this critical resource. Brown has been able to secure hiring authority to place two investigators in her office, and she has appointed a deputy and a public information officer. The board has 9 members and hosts open meetings every month to ensure that Baltimoreans know that Brown's office is available to them. Police are required to share complaints with the Civilian Review Board within 48 hours of receiving a complaint. This doesn't always happen. The police department states that the problem with the complaints is that if someone fails to notarize their statements, they can't make it to her office. Notaries require ID, can be hard to find, and cost money, and that can be a barrier. Another barrier are police unions, who don't love review boards. Recently, Baltimore's local Fraternal Order of Police Lodge tried to secure an injunction to stop the Civilian Review Board from accessing personnel records, but a judge rejected their request, recognizing that this would essentially render their work impossible. In an interview with the Baltimore City paper, Brown expressed some skepticism about the number of complaints being forwarded to her office. She noted, "In any given year, the Civilian Review Board has a high of about 100 complaints, ranging to a low of 51 in 2014, she said. There's no way, in 1 year, we think only 51 people complained about excessive force or harassment.
While Baltimore Police's FIT team and task force were busy investigating the death of Freddie Gray, the state's attorney's office also claimed to be conducting its own investigation. Marilyn Mosby announced charges against six officers 1 day after receiving the binders from Major Branford of the task force. Clearly, her office didn't take the time to evaluate them closely in determining the charges in that 1 day. Branford may not have invented the part about Schatzow being dismissive of the task force's work. Materials, huh? That is exactly how the prosecution team has frequently referred to the BPD investigation. Mosby even suggested as much in her speech announcing the charges.
I would also like to thank the Baltimore City Police Department, particularly Major Branford of the Homicide Unit and Rodney Hill of the Internal Affairs Division, for providing us with a hard copy of their investigative materials yesterday, information that we already had.
Do you hear that little bit of shade? She repeats that elsewhere. She says they had been briefed regularly. None of it was news to them. After the trials ended, one of the lead prosecutors, Michael Schatzow, was asked in a press conference, was there a rush to indict?
I don't think that we felt we were rushing. I don't think we felt that there was material that was overlooked. I think that much of the evidence was in the statements of the officers who gave statements. And those statements were all in by April 17th. So, and if you sort of looked at a timeline from April 12th until the day the indictments were returned, I don't think you would. You wouldn't see a curve going up of increasing evidence as we approached the day of the indictment. I think it would be to the contrary.
According to Schatzow, the police stopped sharing as much with the state's attorney's office when the task force started. But the prosecution had most of what it needed by the 17th, when Porter was interviewed. They had the story of the stops that they then passed on to the medical examiner. A story which helped her determine her autopsy findings, which then circularly reinforced the prosecution's story. Interesting, because Officers Gladhill and Jackson were interviewed after the 17th. So were the civilian witnesses like Tobias Sellers, Harold Perry, and Alethea Booz. I don't know, but their accounts have seemed pretty important to us. Additionally, Mosby's office claimed that they were busy doing their own parallel independent investigation, which Mosby described in her speech announcing the charges.
Once alerted about this incident, on April 13th, investigators from my police integrity unit were deployed to investigate the circumstances surrounding Mr. Gray's apprehension. Over the course of our independent investigation in the untimely death of Mr. Gray, my team worked around the clock, 12 and 14-hour days, to canvass and interview dozens of witnesses, view numerous hours of video footage, repeatedly reviewed and listened to hours of police videotaped statements, surveyed the route, reviewed voluminous medical records, and we leveraged the information made available to us by the police department, the community, and the family of Mr. Gray.
By saying this on such a large public stage, Mosby put her office in a bind. She indicated that they acted as an independent law enforcement agency with its own investigators. In a number of pretrial motions, the defense lawyers pressed Mosby's office to share its investigative materials, even emails, phone records, and drafts of Mosby's speech. All of this, they claimed, counted as discovery, since Mosby's office admitted to acting as a police entity. Eventually, in a September 2015 hearing, Judge Williams pushed Bledsoe to spell out exactly what the state's attorney's independent investigation comprised of in the following exchange. In this reenactment, Amelia will be playing the part of Bledsoe, while I will appear as Judge Williams. Let me ask you a question. It has been stated many times that the state's attorney's office did their own thorough, independent investigation. And so, based on the request, the joint request of the defendants to your office, what did you turn over? I don't have that. So what did you turn over based on that?
Your Honor, we turned over several videos. We turned over 200 photographs. We turned over a witness interview.
You said a witness interview.
Yes, a witness, a separate witness interview than the video that Ms. Flynn is referring to.
Okay.
We had originally...
Well, hold on. I'm writing this down. Witness interview, photos. How many photos?
Over 200.
Okay. And then you said videos of interviews?
We turned over the witness interview that we conducted at the very beginning, Ms. Craddock.
Right. But is that separate from the videos that she talked about?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Okay, so your witness interview of Ms. Craddock, you said?
Interview with Ms. Craddock.
Okay. And then the videos of the interviews with the people in the community, which is how she described it?
There is a video.
Okay, how many people on the video?
3 unidentified community members who would not identify themselves.
Okay, so 3 unidentified people.
And?
Who did the interview?
One of our investigators.
Okay, so that was done by an investigator. Okay, hold on 1 second. And she indicated that there are 2 pages that describe the witness interviews. Is that separate and apart, or?
Your Honor, we gave over 7 pages of investigative notes.
Okay, I'm only going by what I'm told and what you're telling me. That's what we're here to figure out.
Yes.
So you say that you turned over 7 pages.
Well, there's 7 investigative notes.
What does that mean?
That means that there were 7 reports that were generated by...
Okay.
Investigators.
Okay, so 7 reports.
And they could be 1 page. They could have been 2 pages.
Okay. But as far as interviews of individuals, you're saying that all that you turned over was the 1 witness interview by Ms. Craddock and a video that has 3 unidentified people, which was done by one of your investigators?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And so there were no other interviews that you had because...
Right.
If you did, then you would have turned them over.
That is absolutely correct.
And the investigative notes, what are they involving?
The investigative notes involve canvassing. Like, for instance, knocking on the door and somebody saying, you know, I didn't see anything. I did see anything.
And did you... When you turn that over, did you indicate who was doing the canvassing on your part, on the part of your office?
It was one of our investigators, and I don't know if, like, right off the top of my head, whether it was signed by an investigator.
Okay. And was it the same investigator who did all 7 investigative reports?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You said there were 7 investigative reports. Was it all done by the same investigator?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It was done.
Okay. So, done by one person. Okay. Okay, go ahead.
You mean what else we turned over, Your Honor?
Uh-huh.
We turned over all the medical records, which we had gotten prior to the police department, so all of Mr. Gray's medical records.
When you say all, what do you mean by all?
I mean...
Coming from where? When? What time frame?
Concerning this incident, coming from shock trauma.
Concerning... Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. It was roughly 1,000 to 1,500 pages.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Photographs, but I already... Well, that was just of the community.
Okay, anything else that you listed that you turned over?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, all right. Continue, I just wanted to make sure we're clear here.
Oh, we did turn over the first responder curriculum.
Say that again.
It's the first responder course curriculum. As soon as we got it, we turned that over.
Well, where did you get that?
From the police department.
Okay. First responder course curriculum.
Ms. Flynn already referred to that. It was a slideshow.
I believe that's what I received yesterday.
It was a slideshow.
Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead.
I mean, that's other than just the initial discovery, I think we're up to 7,000 pages, roughly, of total discovery. I'm telling you way more. But we have complied with every, even overly cautiously complied with it. Even in my narrow reading, I have persuaded to give up more than I believe that we should be giving up.
All right. Bledsoe here is pushed to admit that their independent investigation consisted of a few interviews and some notes that might have fit on one page. When Mosby said that her department did an independent investigation, I think she meant that her own investigators were reviewing the available information provided to them by the police, not that they were collecting their own discoveries. She maybe didn't choose her words carefully. Mosby was deeply critical of the police investigation when the trials ended. She gave a press conference that day.
There were individual police officers. There were individual police officers that were witnesses to the case, yet were part of the investigative team. Interrogations that were conducted without asking the most poignant questions. Lead detectives that were completely uncooperative and started a counter-investigation to disprove the state's case.
She's talking about Novak, right? And the softball interviews of Boyd and Teal, and the task force's bias. But it all seems like a bit of a contradiction coming from her. The investigation was flawed, it was compromised, she says. But, according to Schatzow, it provided enough information upon which to base serious charges against six officers. The state's attorney's office cannot have its cake and eat it too. That's something Porter's defense attorney said in a motion about this very contradiction. In other words, it can't be a victim of a poor investigation and insist that the investigation gave them all that it needed. So there's one last investigation that we haven't covered. According to the Federal Department of Justice, it has been investigating the death of Freddie Gray and continues to do so today. This investigation has actually affected our podcast's access to information. On April 21st, 2015, 2 days after Freddie Gray's death, the DOJ announced that it would be opening an official probe into Freddie Gray's death to see if there were any civil rights violations by officers. 2 days later, our binders show, BPD fulfilled an FBI request for CCTV video. They passed on the same CCTV excerpts that they would later upload onto YouTube. This was the only motion that we found in the binders of the FBI or any other federal agency being involved. Then, on May 1st, after the charges were announced, the mayor put out a statement saying, quote, "Even as the Baltimore City State's attorney conducts her investigation, it is important to remember that another outside independent investigation is also taking place by the U.S. Department of Justice." 5 days later, the mayor announced that the DOJ was going to conduct a broader investigation into BPD generally. This would lead to the big report on Baltimore policing and the consent decree. But, the mayor insisted, the feds would continue to investigate the death of Freddie Gray separately. Then we didn't hear anything about a federal investigation for over a year. Our podcast was set to receive 4,000 pages of materials from BPD in November in response to a Public Information Act request. Then, on January 11th, we received a letter from BPD denying our request based on an open investigation into the death of Freddie Gray with the Department of Justice. This supposedly gave BPD the legal authority to deny our request. The letter was also sent to other media outlets, like The Sun. We've dug around to see if this federal investigation was really happening before and after Trump took office. I mean, Trump has repeatedly vowed to cut funding for any investigations into police, explicitly. I have made continued requests to the DOJ for information. Every response I've gotten has been the same. Quote, "The DOJ investigation into Freddie Gray's death is ongoing." Okay. I reached out to attorney Mark Zayan, who represented Officer Nero. He said that he hadn't heard one thing about a federal investigation. We contacted a source within the prosecution team who said that they hadn't been contacted once about it, and they didn't believe it was actually happening. Neither the defense nor the prosecution had received one request from the federal government for files, interviews, or anything. What kind of investigation is this? The Attorney General's office in Maryland includes more than one disgruntled former state's attorney staffer. Like Carrie Borzalieri, she unsuccessfully sued Marilyn Mosby for wrongful termination. I don't know, maybe the AG's office has a stake in helping BPD block information. The Maryland Attorney General, until recently, was Rod Rosenstein. He is now the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. We hope that his access helps speed along this 2-year federal investigation. We look forward to the results.
If history is written by the winners, current events are written by, you guessed it, the media. The power of a narrative that takes hold in the public discourse can have grave consequences, and much of that power, while now a bit diluted thanks to online tools, is still in the hands of the mainstream media. In a democracy, an independent press is key to making sure the narratives presented to the public are unbiased and accurate. It is a great responsibility, and it's why the press is known as the Fourth Estate, a power that helps keep the other powers accountable. But it's a tough line to walk, because the media has to keep both power accountable. At the same time, they have to be very, very close to it just to get the story. And that proximity always comes with a price. Next time on Undisclosed.
Hi, listeners. So, we have a live event coming up. As you know from the update episode, Adnan Syed has a big hearing coming up on June 8th. After the day's events in court, the podcasting crew is going to get together in Baltimore to record a live episode where we'll discuss updates in Adnan's case, our current story arc on Freddie Gray, and maybe even talk a bit more about what else we've got planned for 2017. All right, so it's going down on Thursday, June 8th at 6:30 p.m. at one of my favorite spots in Baltimore, Red Emma's Bookstore. Red Emma's is at 30 West North Avenue. Come on out. It's free. You can meet the crew, talk about podcasting, and just generally have a great time. Once again, it's on June 8th at 6:30 p.m. at Red Emma's in Baltimore. We really hope to see you there. Okay, second piece of business. As you know, Undisclosed relies on advertising to keep this show free. If you do us a favor, go to the following URL. It's podcastlistener.com/undisclosed. Answer a few short questions there. It would be super helpful. The questions allow us to better get to know you and for our sponsors to get to know you. Again, that's podcastlistener.com/undisclosed. And on to the credits. Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 12, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marcia Shatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote this episode. Methil Telhan produced, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media, and our great sponsors this week were WAG and Third Love. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you, and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for discussion about this week's episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag Freddie Gray or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then.